You're listening to Greater LA, KCRW's show that connects you to the people and places of Southern California. I'm Steve Chiotakis.
Oh, smart.
USC Village is a nexus for the university's student body. It's a place where you can grab a bite, buy some groceries, and in the case of Sasan Yousafi, talk politics.
So, you know, the United States is famous as land of opportunity. So if you think you can rock the world, rock something, so that's right place for you. In the whole United States, California is famous as the best one, especially for immigrants and especially for Iranian. There are a lot of Iranian here. 800,000 Persian live in Los Angeles and OC. So it's biggest Persian hub out of Iran. And for sure, that's an advantage for you as an immigrant.
Sasan is one of about 150 international students from Iran studying at USC. And for years, generations even, traveling to the United States for a graduate-level education has been a rite of passage for Iran's brightest. But since the inauguration of President Donald J. Trump, things have changed. For one thing, Trump pulled the U.S. out of the Iran nuclear deal, and once again, tensions with the country are high. Most recently, just a couple of weeks ago, about 20 Iranian students enrolled in American universities with valid U.S. visas couldn't board their flights to the United States. Most of those students had been accepted to universities here in California. Jamal Abdi is the executive director of the nonprofit National Iranian American Council. He says it's a big loss for the U.S.
Some could argue that certain industries like Silicon Valley were built by immigrants from Iran who came here on student visas and were able to get green cards and founded these startups and essentially, you know, played a major role in building that industry and other contributions in the sciences and academia and business. That pathway for Iranians to be able to come here as students is essentially being closed.
The president's travel ban, for example, has prevented many Iranian nationals from being able to enter the U.S., let alone study here. And U.S. sanctions have crippled the Iranian economy.
So on top of all of that, if you've made it through all of those barriers, now the United States is saying there's a chance that your visa may be revoked as you try to step foot on the airplane to come to the U.S. to start or resume your studies.
Back to Sasan Yousafi at USC. He considers himself lucky. He's in his 30s. He's tall, unshaven. He wears shorts and a T-shirt, like a lot of other students hanging out near campus. Before he sits down to chat outside a Starbucks, he props a single crutch against the glass window surrounding the storefront. Sasan's still recovering from a bike accident and a couple of surgeries that he needed to put his left leg back together.
So I'll start recording, is it okay?
Okay.
Sasan's been here for 3 years, getting his master's in construction management, but he says things haven't been easy. He sat down with KCRW's Benjamin Gottlieb to talk about how he and other students from Iran are dealing with the increasing uncertainty.
What is your immigration status and how are you going to school here?
Yeah, so for me it was a little chance actually. When I was in last semester in university, Tehran University, in Master of Business Administration, by chance I win green card in lottery. And I came to United States exactly the day Donald Trump became president.
Since then, things have been more difficult.
Yeah. It's become really, really more difficult. Visiting the family is a big issue. I had a friend here last year, a sad story, that he was from great university. He was from Caltech, and he was in PhD. His father had cancer. He was not sure if he can go to Iran or not. He talked with his father, I should come. And then father said, no, they will not let you come back to the United States. And he died. He died and he didn't see his father. You know, I know a lot of stories, sad stories like this. And you think to yourself, what's the point? You know, and we're talking about talented students. We're not talking about the people who come here and working in a black market or something like that. We are talking about PhD students, postdoc students from top universities here.
I mean, this is the cream of the crop coming from Iran trying to get an advanced degree in the United States.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. And you know, a lot of other problems for the people, even, for example, for me, as you see, I have a problem in my leg. So I had an accident like 7 months ago. And after that terrible accident, which was very bad, I was in a wheelchair for 6 months. And I had 2 times surgery. I sent some letter from hospital to Iran, to embassy, to make a Muslim wayfarer ban for my mother. She wanted to come to help me, and the hospital said, yeah, he needs someone to help him for 90 days.
So you wanted your mother to come to the United States to help take care of you?
Yeah, yeah, for some months, for 1 month, something like that. And my mother has been here for five times before. They did not let my mother to come. And I'm sure there are a lot of stories like this happening. But if it's your Iranian, it means that you cannot travel. Nobody can come and see you. And, you know, it's really sad. I can remember it was a week ago. I told some of my friends that we were eating some food. I told him, you know, I really miss my mother's cooking. And he laughed and said, you know, dude, it's more than 8 years. I haven't eaten my mother's food, so I completely forget his food. I mean, the food is not important part of it. It has some meaning inside it. You forget who are your family. You forget them because you just see them on FaceTime and Viber for like 5 years, 10 years. And if this regulation passed, more than 10 years probably. So it's really sad story.
A lot of Iranian students have been reticent to talk about this. They're worried about having their name in the press. They're worried about having their pictures out there, their story out there. There's various reasons. Can you explain to me why, and also why you think it's important to talk about this?
Yeah, so first of all, don't forget, we are coming from the country which can make problem for you if you do some political thing. However, it's not political interview you're doing, or even social activity, you know. So they have that background in their mind. Oh, if I do something like this, I can be in problem. And for this interview, even as we talk, I asked some of my friends, they were not interested because they're scared. They say, okay, we are waiting for our green card, or we want to apply, we're a student here, we don't want to be in problem. But the problem that we have is that we feel like it's not fair, the thing that's going to the Persian in compared to other people.
Where do you think this goes from here? You know, again, we've heard reports now that at least 20, maybe more Iranian students with valid visas have showed up to airports, been rejected, denied entry, so to speak. What comes next? Does this escalate? What's going to happen?
Yeah, for sure, less students is coming. A lot of them prefer to not apply. It's a lot of expense to apply for the United States, and at the end, they don't give you visa. And as I said, there are a lot of other plans, like going to Canada, going to Australia. And don't forget, these students, they're coming, a lot of students who come to the United States, you know, they're coming from 5-10 universities. You know, they're very top university of Iran. And so those students are connected to each other. And these kinds of news get viral, and they're very fast, you know. It's going very fast through them. Oh, they don't give us visa, so don't apply for them. Let's go to Canada. Let's go to Germany. There are some other options that right now, like that's not there.
Well, Sasan, it really was great to meet you.
Thank you. Yeah, thank you for having me, and thank you for having this program, which can tell little to the people what's going on about Iranian community.
That's Sasan Yousafi speaking with KCRW's Benjamin Gottlieb. Well, just ahead, chronicling on stage the gang days of the 60s and 70s in East Los Angeles. You're listening to Greater LA on KCRW.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Steve Chiatakis back with Greater LA on KCRW. The Casa 0101 Theater in Boyle Heights has a hit play on its hands. Always Running was originally scheduled to close in just a couple of weeks, but the theater's actually extended the play through November 24th. It's an adaptation of Luis Rodriguez's famous 1993 memoir, Always Running, La Vida Loca, Gang Days in L.A., the book connected powerfully with Latinx residents in East L.A., and now the adapted play is doing the same. Eric Galindo is managing editor over at L.A. Taco. He has seen the play, and he joins me right now. Hi, Eric.
Hey, how you doing?
I'm all right. For people who don't know Rodriguez's book, what is the book about?
So the book is kind of about a kid who's a smart kid, knows what's up, talented, but feels kind of, loyal to his neighborhood in a way that when you grow up not having anything, you kind of feel like where you live is all you have and the people you grew up with.
Wow.
So it creates loyalty, and it sort of, he joins the gangs there, the local gang, and has to kind of struggle with coming of age in a time when, you know, the police are kind of against them because he's a gang member, and the rival gangs are shooting at him. And so it's kind of just, how do you come of age in a time in LA when everyone's trying to kill you?
A pretty violent time in LA, right?
Yeah. And it was during, you know, the 60s and 70s, which are often seen as kind of like, you know, hippie days, or you have this idea of like free love and all that. But there was, you know, also the gang wars in LA. It's very much this history of Los Angeles, and because we often feel so invisible, even in our own, you know, city where we're the majority almost, it's refreshing to see a part of that history portrayed, you know, in a very intellectual way.
You said that it didn't completely follow along with the book. Like, what were the differences, do you think?
Well, the book is definitely way more, you know, it gets really more in detail into much of the history of that era of the 60s, the 70s, and it gets into the weeds of, you know, what it means to, for example, your, you know, 16-year-old Cholo, what it meant to him to bang his neighborhood. And the play seems more like, I want to say kind of like memories. Like I think I wrote for LA Taco, and I talk about how I felt like a personification of our collective memory.
Yeah.
Which is kind of, you know, plays ask us to suspend disbelief, right? Like there's no CGI, there's no crazy production. It's very, very played down, very minimal. So it's
you make accommodations.
Yeah, so yeah. It's in your brain. So like the way it's laid out in your head is just the story of this kid and how he was talented and he was trying even when he was his own worst enemy and when he also had enemies without. So in many ways, you do kind of feel like that struggle is still very real, especially in Boyle Heights, where you're kind of trying to get ahead. You don't want to be, you know, a bad person, but you have this changing environment.
Well, I mean, you talk about gentrification, right?
Exactly, like
it is a changing environment where people, back in the 60s and 70s, it was pretty much an insular environment, right? It was, I don't want to say it was separated from the rest of LA, but it was a place where people were pretty much the same.
Yeah, it was a place where, you know, middle-class people, working-class people could live and afford to stay there. And I think that's kind of been the history of Boyle Heights since, you know, back when it was a Jewish neighborhood. So when you see something like Always Running, you kind of try to see its place in your mind, its place in current time, and that's why it does feel like very much like our collective memory, our collective interpretation of the history of Los Angeles.
You grew up not too far away in Southeast LA.
Right.
Did it feel like an accurate representation, the book, in your area, the area that you grew up?
Yeah, actually it did. I mean, the book is set in the San Gabriel Valley, but you wouldn't think it. You'd think it's East LA or you'd think it's South Central LA. It doesn't really matter. Like, the book is a part of Los Angeles that is not often seen. So when I was growing up, like, I was kind of, you know, on a bad path. Like, I had basically dropped out of high school. I was, you know, I had my own little crew. You know, we were doing bad things. Like, you know, we weren't getting violent, but we were, you know, break-ins, stuff like that. And, you know, we'd get violent if we had to. And it was very like, you know, the book, when you read it, the play, when you see it, there's a line in both that always stuck with me to this day, which is, we're fighting over land that doesn't belong to us, you know. And that, when I read that, and this was like shortly after the book came out, I was in high school. And it blew my mind. I was like, he's right. Like, what are we doing? Like, this is nonsense. Where this land belongs to the city, belongs to the government. It belongs to people that generally don't want us here. And that's kind of where I turned my life around. And that's kind of the power of this book. I think that that has resonated with a lot of people who were on that path or were in prison. Like, I've talked to my friends who were in jail, and when the book came out and they read it and it turned their life around. So yeah, I would say it's a portrayal of a life lived, you know, in various parts of LA during various times. I don't think there's a reason a book written about the 60s resonates to this day.
In a review, you wrote that it was like watching the movie American Graffiti, but with brown kids. Do you think part of the appeal and part of the popularity of the play is that folks in Boyle Heights and East LA, Southeast LA, where you're from, aren't used to seeing themselves represented in the way that this play does?
For sure, yeah. I love American Graffiti, and because it automatically, like, stabs you in your nostalgia bone. Like, you're just like, oh, dope. You know, even though I didn't grow up in that time, like, I know the cars, you know, the music, like the oldies, the classics.
Well, and Friends, right?
Yeah.
Friends, your group. Yeah, your what would homies, you say? Yeah, your homies.
Yeah. And then when I sat down to watch this play, I was like, holy shit, this is American Graffiti. Like, oh my God. But, you know, there's brown people, and you know, it's like such a real story. It just happens to be set in this, you know, ultra violent world, and that world often doesn't get that sort of agency of like, oh, well, these are just regular people in their bad circumstances.
Well, the play is called Always Running, an adaptation of Luis Rodriguez's 1993 memoir Always Running: La Vida Loca Gang Days in LA. It runs through almost Thanksgiving, November 24th, over at Casa 0101 in Boyle Heights. I want to thank you, Eric Galindo, over from LA Taco. Look where you are now, talking on the radio.
I know, right?
Yeah. Thank you so much.
Appreciate it.
Well, there's a lot going on that stage in East L.A. There's a lot going on in the works of L.A. artist Larry Pittman, the message that he's trying to relay in his art. That's next on KCRW's Greater L.A. Greater LA on KCRW. Onward we go. I'm Steve Chiotakis. Larry Pittman is a prominent fixture of the LA art scene. He is a revered professor over at UCLA, but he's also an artist with LA roots and 40 years of work under his belt. And right now, the Hammer Museum is honoring him with a retrospective that includes about 80 paintings and 50 drawings. That exhibition opens Sunday. It'll be up through the beginning of the year, through January of 2020. Our art insider, Lindsay Preston Zappas, is editor-in-chief at Contemporary Art Review Los Angeles. She's seen the show, and she actually spoke with Pittman about his childhood, his career, and his identity. Hi, Lindsay.
Hey, Steve.
So this museum retrospective is titled Larry Pittman Declaration of Independence, and I was struck by the name because it was like, wait, how is this a Declaration of Independence?
Oh, man, it's such an interesting title because the first thing you think of is the, you know, Declaration of Independence, our founding American years, the forefathers.
Or someone declaring independence from something. So what is he declaring?
Yes, and so that's very much Larry. I mean, he grew up kind of between Columbia and L.A. He's homosexual, and when, you know, he was coming out of school in the 70s, he fought for that identity. And so this show very much is a declaration of his personal identity. But also, he was making paintings at a time that it wasn't really cool to make paintings. And the specific aesthetic of his paintings are really unique. And he's really fought for his own personal aesthetic. So it's really an opportunity for him to be like, hey, this is me. This is 40 years of my work. But then, of course, the sort of American undertones of the title as well. As an artist, he kind of points to the underbelly of American culture and a lot of really dark, violent themes about America. So in a way, using that title is really tongue-in-cheek for him. Like, he's almost using it ironically.
Kind of like Born in the USA by
sure.
Bruce Springsteen, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Or I Love L.A. by Randy Newman, right?
Right.
They don't mean what you think they mean.
Yeah, but I love that kind of dual title. I think it works really well here.
At the outset, I talked about how many years he's been a working artist here in L.A., right, with a lot of L.A. roots. And I've seen some of his work. And when you look at it, you're like, wow, there is a lot going
so
on there.
So much happening. Yeah, they're really dense. There's so much going on. And he doesn't edit for you. You know, he just kind of throws it all on the canvas. So they're very layered, very graphic. He uses a lot of decorative patterning. And at times it has an animation or almost cartoonish quality to it even. But he really just throws it all in. And the curator of the show talks about that as in a way kind of representing the complexity of American life. Like, it's everything all in one soup together. And so much of this comes out of, as I said, him kind of coming out gay in the 70s and really sticking to his own personal style.
I guess also that comes from being gay, is that any type of mandate from culture at large that says reduced to essentials
right.
is really scary to me.
Reduced to essentials.
Right. And he says he doesn't do that in his work or for the viewer. He doesn't make it easy for you. And I think that's a really important part of talking and thinking about his work.
Just looking again at those paintings, there's so much to take in. There's so much going on. And what is it you're trying to decipher? I mean, we talk about sort of this polarity or this duality, right? There are so many different things happening
yeah.
at the same time.
Yeah. And just to throw out some examples, like he might have some violent imagery of guns or hatchets or nooses alongside bunny rabbits or a beautiful figure or really beautiful floral imagery. So he's really mixing those together. And, you know, this has to do with the fact that he is Colombian and American and grew up split between those places, but also his identity, again, as a homosexual in a very patriarchal male society. And so I think those opposites really inflect his work.
Maybe if the work produces some anxiety in the viewer,
yeah.
I'm not unaware of this, is that there is no ETA of meaning in the work.
Yeah.
You know, that the work is to be revisited and re-experienced, hopefully over and over and over again.
And, you know, that's what any artist will tell you
yeah.
over and over again. They say, take a look at it again. Maybe, you know, have some dinner and come back and take a look at it again. Or take a toke and, tell me what, you know, there are so many, because they don't want you to just look at it once.
Yeah, right. And I think, but he does leave it open for you to really invent your own narrative and invent your own kind of opinions of the work.
And dig for the meaning.
Exactly. And they come from very specific places, very specific themes. But he opens it to you as the viewer to have your own interpretation.
I think the work is visually available to a huge range of people.
Right.
You know, that it's visually available. Yes, okay, it is complicated and complex, and maybe the viewer should give it more time, but they should also trust their feelings as well
uh-huh.
and their own ideas about it.
Right.
You know, and go with it.
Right.
You know.
What is your takeaway from all of this?
I mean, it's just such a stunning exhibition, again, of someone that's so revered in L.A. L.A. really celebrates artists that put in time, you know, and he teaches here. And I think this exhibition really shows his influence and shows the impact that he's had visually on a whole generation of artists. But again, Declaration of Independence, it's just his style is so at the forefront of this, and he's unapologetic about it.
And again, so many things happening at one time because there are so many things in his life happening at one time.
And in American life, American culture, in politics, it's simultaneous. And that's the complexity that I think is really at the heart of his work.
Well, the retrospective's over at the Hammer Museum through January 5th, 2020. The full interview, by the way, at your podcast.
Yes. So we actually interviewed Larry for the Carla podcast, which I host, which launches on Friday. So you can check that out on the Carla podcast wherever you get your podcasts.
Indeed. Lindsay Preston-Zappas, our art insider for KCRW. Lindsay, thanks.
Thanks, Steve.
And by the way, you can check out more from Lindsay, not only by the podcast, her podcast, but signing up for her weekly art insider newsletter through KCRW at kcrw.com/greaterLA. And while you're searching for podcasts, how about subscribing to ours, hey? KCRW.com/GreaterLA. We'd love to see you there. That is all the time that we have for today. Tomorrow, a rising homeless population is leading to rising anger in the community among residents who are now, or some of whom, are taking it out on the homeless. Jenna Cagle, PJ Shahamat, Sonia Geis, Ray Guarna, Phil Richards, Christine Comito, and Christian Bordahl all make this show happen. I'm Steve Chiotakis. Thanks for your ear. Have a great day.